Good evening. Welcome to part two in health, wealth, and happiness, in that order. Last week we covered the topic of health. And one point we made, which is relevant to wealth and happiness as well, is that we live in an age totally unique in the history of mankind for many reasons. And one reason that stands out is that we have more access to information on finances, investments, opportunities in business, skills galore. It's possible for a person to have, in this generation, multiple careers. There was a time when, if you looked at someone's resume, 5 years in this department, 10 years in sales, 8 years in marketing, and now they're coming to you and you say, well, no, can't this person keep a job? Today, we have a situation where the more skills a person has, the more likely they will be able to find employment. And yet, with all the clarity that's available to us on wealth, investments, saving, is it true that we have a correlated satisfaction in career? Or do we find that people are as much financially irresponsible or out of tune as any other time in history, if not worse? And that financial stress, not necessarily related to not having enough money, even those who have adequate salary to cover their expenses and beyond, financial stress remains a major cause for heart disease, heart attacks, even cancer. So, is it possible in the short space of an hour to somehow uncomplicate the wealth of information on wealth and ask ourselves from a Torah perspective, from God's point of view, if I have any right to say that I'm representing what he would say on the matter, but obviously I will quote from the Talmud and other sources to help bring some clarity. Is it possible that in this short 1 hour or so, we will be able to walk out this room with a different clarity on what it means wealth, what it means to enjoy the money that we do have, and have a different confidence about earning power, staying power in one's employment, fulfillment of aspirations in one's career, and perhaps most importantly, the intro into next week, a happiness, a satisfaction that comes from knowing where I'm going financially, as of today, say, and into the future. Ladies and gentlemen, the entire subject of today can be based on this. The number one tried and tested secret of building wealth is spend less than you earn and invest the difference in your own future. Thank you for listening. Are there any questions? You think I'm joking? Actually, I have prepared a little bit more to say. The rest of this evening's presentation is a commentary on this one line. Building wealth, and this has been documented, and I'm even going to tell you it's the Talmud alone, this has been documented and researched in some of the bestsellers on the New York best-selling list, that spending less than one earns and investing the difference in one's future is the, if you're going to look at any one of the strategies that you would identify in interviewing millionaires and multimillionaires, this is the one strategy that comes up most frequently, again and again and again. It's not the place tonight to explain why it is and how it is that amongst many causes, the media has so sensationalized people who have large salaries, especially rock stars, actors, actresses, baseball players, football players, to the extent that children, teenagers plus get the impression that a large salary is the main cause for making it big in money and in bucks. And yet, statistically, what shows up again and again is that less than gaining wealth from inheritance, less than gaining wealth from income, and less than gaining wealth from marrying into wealth is wealth from invested income. Invested income is only something that is either theoretical or practical if I already know how much I'm spending and my income is above that, or if I'm spending above my income to lower the spending so that it is within my means, and even a little bit more so that I can put money aside and say no to smaller things today, smaller items of immediate gratification, in order to say yes to items of greater lasting value tomorrow. It is a sad fact that in America, 96% of Americans are not financially independent. The definition on the research paper that makes this claim, the definition for independence means that the amount of money that is earned from invested income and other assets is equal to the expense of their lifestyle, which essentially means that by the time a person reaches 64, retirement, and starts to sign for one's social security paychecks, almost always that check will not cover the lifestyle that I am used to, and I have one of two choices: to drastically cut down on the way I live, which is a pity because that's not what I necessarily worked for my old age, or go back to work till the grave, which is not a very encouraging thought. So the question we are going to address tonight from a Torah's perspective is, let us ask ourselves, does the Torah have a different definition for wealth to start with? And if it does, what is that definition? And in identifying that definition and its application, let's look very seriously at the how-to of earning, saving, investing, and ultimately the security that comes from planning and knowing in advance, not hoping, but expecting, that if I play the formula of living within my means and investing the difference, I can know up front what to expect 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years down the line, depending on how much I'm able to put aside. Of course, there are many objections. Wait a minute, I'm on a salary, it's a fixed salary. How can I possibly work within that? We're going to address that as well. I'm going to begin at the beginning, and that is, if God is the genesis of the entire monetary system, being that He is the one that commands us to give one-tenth of our income to charity, and today is not a lecture on charity for me to give a full definition of what's included in one-tenth. Is it right off the top of your paycheck? Is it after you've already paid off certain amounts of money, for example, tuition, etc.? That's a separate issue. But the very fact that the Creator says give one-tenth to charity already clearly indicates that I have to know what my total income is in order to be able to identify, am I fulfilling this instruction of 10%? And being that this 10% is not necessarily off the top of my paycheck, it has to be after considering I'm paying for my children above the age of 6 for their tuition and shelter, which according to Jewish law, interestingly enough, If you support your child beyond the age of six, that's called charity. Absolutely. And therefore, it's considered tax exempt. So you're exempt from this 10% tax if you're already paying for their tuition and their food and their clothing and their private tutoring and whatever else that you're paying for, which is part of their basic needs, then I have to know what my expenses are, the categories of my expenses, in order to correctly fulfill God's will in taking off this 10%. Because what happens if I'm taking off the 10% and the rest of my family is suffering and I don't realize I may be exempt from that 10% because I'm already supporting children above the age of 6. And I may not be correctly fulfilling this mitzvah, this instruction. And so we see that in this command are two assumables. Number one, I can identify what 10% is because I know how much I'm earning. And number two, how much I'm spending and what those categories are. But let's begin at the very beginning. What is the purpose of money, being that God is the one that originally invented it?
Exchange.
Exchange, trade, exchange of services. I'm going to begin at the very beginning, and that is the following. When our soul, our neshama, first entered the body, God already determined whether that person will be wealthy or poor. We're going to have to identify some interesting pieces of information, which initially is going to look a little bit blurry. How am I going to understand this all? Guess what it says. Hello? Hello? Not working. If I'm going to identify a number of statements from our sages, from the oral transmission from Sinai, that relate to money, and there will be apparent contradictions, and hopefully through this exploration we'll be able to come to a clarity of a very clear system of how to view in our attitude money and how to practically use money as a means for increasing pleasure, comfort, contribution, charity. Yes, madam? I'm trying to use the microphone, but it's not working. But I will do my best to project my voice. Is that better? Yeah? If there's anyone at the back that has a difficulty in hearing me, I urge you to move forward because there are some seats up front. And that will be a kindness to your ears and a kindness to my throat. Testing. When God placed our soul in our body, our wealth was determined, our height was determined, how beautiful or handsome was determined, but one thing was not determined: whether a person will be righteous or not. That's okay. Okay. Madam, can you hear me now?
We can harmonize.
When the soul entered the body, we were told that the soul refused to enter until God made it swear, Tiyeh tzaddik, be righteous. Va'al tiyeh rasha, do not be wicked. Why did the soul resist entering the body? Because it was worried that with all the trials and tribulations, the tests and challenges of earning a living, raising a family, maintaining a happy marriage, and that pretty much covers the whole gamut, the fear of not being successful in those areas meant that the soul would rather stay at home and not come down into this planet, this earthly body, where it had to make choices to act righteously or not. It only agreed when it was forced to swear that it would pursue a life of righteousness. Now let me ask you, Anyone here who is an avid sports follower will know, is there a successful athlete that can gain a gold medal in the Olympics without a coach? In theory, it's possible. Has it ever really happened? Why not? Why is it that every athlete needs a coach? And we know the answer is that the coach is going to consistently hold them to a higher standard. And yet, on my own, left on my own, I will not force myself to find out how high is my highest, how far is my furthest, how far can I truly reach. I'm easily going to say, I have arrived. God puts us in a world and says, I cannot be your personal coach, because if I reveal myself openly, directly in your life, you will lose your free will, so to speak, in realizing, hey, God, you're there all along. And therefore, every good choice will be effortless, and I will not be able to reward you to the maximum. So God says, I have provided three coaches that I am going to put in your lives. One is a spouse, marriage. Your spouse is your coach in righteousness. Number two, children. Very trying. And number three, earning a living. Tonight we're talking about earning a living. That earning a living is that area, that place where God has deliberately designed that we are confronted on a daily basis with questions of honesty, integrity, keeping our word, doing our best, punctuality, holding to the terms of the contract. And it goes further than that. Getting along with a difficult boss, a difficult co-worker, a not easy client. We all know that we feel accomplishment when we control our anger, when we give someone the benefit of the doubt, and they appreciate and notice and are grateful. The workplace, struggling to earn a buck, to pay the bills, and yet not trample on people, is a major test, challenge, and playfield for me to get strong in my muscles for training in honesty, integrity, and getting along with other people, especially people who are difficult. And so God essentially invented the stomach in order that there should be a financial system. Absolutely serious, and this relates to last week. God invented the stomach. In fact, I think it was one of the Rishonim, one of the earlier sages, that asked the question, why didn't God design a much more superior respiratory system and provide all the nutrients, all the amino acids, all the proteins in the oxygen of the air, and all you and I would do is, the air is so beautiful, so delicious, and no food, no drink. All the energy would be in the air, would be translated in our body into energy, and that's it. No paycheck, no having to go to work. And the answer is that God wanted to force us to go to work in order to be in confrontation with people and put on an agenda respect versus money. My word, my integrity, my self-respect versus my personal agenda to want more, to afford more, to buy more, to live a higher lifestyle. So that I'm in consistent conflict with the muscles of patience and love and sensitivity, consideration, respect all the time in the workplace. And the agenda is not an easy one for us to balance. So here we are, looking to get gold medals in the righteous Olympics. That is why God created money. If we take a toll of everyone in the audience, each one will probably give a different definition of the type of career that you're in. I want to suggest although you may have considered this many times, that besides whatever job one has as a vocation, one is a financial planner whether we like it or not. We might be good or not very good at it. But if I own a home, or I pay a mortgage, or I pay rent, I'm automatically involved in real estate. If I cash in a check and pay my grocery bills, utilities, I'm automatically in business. I'm dealing and bartering and exchanging of services consistently. So essentially, we are, whether we like it or not, we are all self-employed in a specific business called personal financial planning, and the extent to which we have planned out how much we earn and what our real expenses are and what we want to save for and what we want to enjoy and live for and afford later on in our lives is very much determined by a plan in the first place. Let me share with you the following statements from our sages that apparently are in conflict, but as we put them together, the clarity hopefully will give us a system to understand the purpose of finances, and then we can look more practically at the applications. The prophet Haggai said, "Li hakesef v'li hazahav ne'um Hashem tzvakais." God declares, I own all the silver and all the gold. I, the one who created the universe, all the stars, there's nothing I do not own. We actually say every day in our prayers, Koineh HaKol, you own everything. Which is said, no owners, everything is on loan. Everything that we have in our name is actually a loan to us. And in that sense, our clothes is a test. Which clothes to wear as a statement of who I am in this relationship, at work, or with my family. How we respect ourselves by the way we dress. The possessions we choose, what type of car. And it's interesting to note that many multi-millionaires worked very hard for their money and would never buy a brand new car. And if they would, they would run it into at least 4 years of good use before trading it in. Interesting. The point that's coming out here is that how we use our possessions is a result of the principles that govern our attitude towards wealth. Our attitude towards exemplifying or demonstrating my wealth in public. That is why I once opened up a Sotheby's magazine to see a painting. A red L shape with a black dot in the middle, which was only going for $5 million. My 6-year-old daughter can do just as good. But the fact of the matter is, if someone is willing to pay $5 million for such a piece of art, essentially the message that they are claiming is, I'm quantifying my wealth on my wall. If I can afford an L with a dot in the middle at the tune of $5 million, just imagine what my true assets really are. Now, I'm not suggesting that's the psychological background behind this buy, but we understand that whenever a person chooses a particular model, car, the way to decorate our home, it's all a reflection of a statement. And yet we know that the essence of the home is not the building, materials, and decorations. It's the essence of the home is, of course, the people inside. How we are as people and how we interact is the real place of operations. Real wealth, we are told, Ashirut, is happiness. Happiness is real wealth. Financial wealth is an aspect of wealth. In Western society, our faces, our minds are bombarded every day by commercials and advertisements that are trying to convince us, and successfully so, that wealth is synonymous to the amount of money, and that reflects how much I can afford and what lifestyle I can afford. But we all know, if we ask the most simple questions, which would matter more to us as loving, caring parents? That our children would have unlimited financial resources, choice number one, or they would be financially responsible. And decisions they make would be based on tried and tested principles of financial responsible money management. And if we ask this question, which of the two would we prefer for our child, and which of the two is more likely to create the result of enjoying one's wealth, maintaining one's wealth, and even building wealth? Having a jump start of unlimited resources, or financial principles, financial responsibility? And we know from statistics, 87% of lottery winners have lost their millions within a decade. And it's not only the money that they lost, it's also family feuds and relationships, divorce and broken marriages with all the pain that goes with it, and if they're older in life, children vying for the will. Pain, full of it. What matters more? So we know that the word wealth, even before we start looking at the Torah sources, when we consider it rationally and with intellectual honesty, we understand that real wealth is not my financial portfolio alone. There's a lot more. Where does health rate in the full gamut of wealth? How many people would pay a fortune to live a little bit longer or to enjoy more health? So we understand immediately which of the two takes priority. Where does happy family relationships rate in terms of assets? If we were to project, contrast them against financial assets, we will know that our ultimate happiness is far more strongly related to enjoying relationships with our family, our parents, our siblings, our spouse, our children, our marriage, far more than the wealth that we invest our energy and time into. So we have to consider here that the Torah version of health, wealth, and happiness is a very broad one. It's not exclusive to the concept of finances. We have another statement in the Talmud Beitza, page 16a. Kol mizaynoysav shel Adam katsuvim loy mirosh Hashanah. The entire amount of money that a person will earn in the year after Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of the Jewish New Year, has been calculated to the penny. And this means that if I were to put in an extra 1,000 hours over time, I will not gain a penny more than has been allotted at Rosh Hashanah. And if I don't work at all, whatever's been allotted will find itself in my lap. But this statement is difficult to understand on its own, because when we start traveling through the other pages of the Talmud, we see very clearly that there's a prayer. There's part of the Amidah, the standing Shmona Esrei, that standing prayer that we say every day, 3 times a day, and the prayer is specific to, please God, grant me wealth. Give me the money that I need to support my family. Barakenu, bless us. And we're talking about livelihood. Not only that, in Tractate Yuma, page 35a, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, the holiest person in the Jewish nation, on the holiest day of the year, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, enters the Holy of Holies, the holiest place on earth. And it's a one-time occasion, once a year, that this person enters that place at that time. And he's only there for a short few moments. What prayer does he offer up to the Creator in these precious moments? It must be the most important on the agenda, surely. And yet, what do we find? What are the words that he utters? Sorry, it's page 53b in Yuma. He says, may it be your will, Hashem, our God, that this year be a year of plenty in rain and bountiful produce, and your people should not need each other for financial assistance. V'lo yiyu amcha Yisrael tzrichim lefanes zeh mizeh. Wait a minute. Is this a religion of spirituality or what? And the answer is financial freedom or financial flexibility allows a person's mind to be freed up and consider more worthwhile pursuits. That the money, of course, is only the means to something greater, and that if people are enjoying a life of taking care of their needs without having to come onto someone else, it will free us up to focus on what really counts: our marriage and our children. Being more acutely aware of our integrity in our relationships, at work, with our friends, our neighbours, extended family. So what do we see here? On the one hand, we're told the amount of money we're going to earn is fixed, and yet we're told to pray. It seems a contradiction, but it doesn't stop there. The Talmud also tells us, in Tractate Shabbos, page 156a, Ein mazel l'Yisrael. Jews have no luck. No mazel. Now mazel literally translates as constellations, the stars. And what is the meaning of this Talmudical statement? That we have no luck. The stars have already dictated our fate. The answer is that prayer takes us beyond our mazel, beyond our fate, beyond our constellations. But we have the power to change what has been allotted to us. We have the power through our words, prayer, and efforts, actions, to change by demonstration of our will through our mouth and demonstration of what we do, our actions, which ultimately are a reflection of our will. We have the ability to change what has been allotted to us. So what does it mean that the amount of money has been allotted on Rosh Hashanah can be changed by our prayers? Really means the following. God calculates, based on who I am now, what my needs are. Not just to support the grocery bills, but emotionally and spiritually, the direction I'm going in, what maintenance does God need to sign on this check that will fulfill the capacity that I'm shooting for? Which medal am I looking to attain in the Righteous Olympics? And so God says, you, by prayer and effort and willpower, can change the amount that's coming to you because of the size, the capacity of the tank that we decide we want to be able to fill with righteous conduct and deeds, kindness, generosity, consideration, sensitivity in our relationships. The respect we have for ourselves and the respect that we have for those closest to us, our friends, etc. So here, what starts to unfold is that God is setting an amount and giving us freedom to set that amount at a different level. This concept actually explains a lot of contradictions, which is not the purpose of tonight's presentation, but I will share with you the following. The Talmud in Nida, page 70, has their 12 famous questions asked by the Greeks to the Jewish sages. And one of them was, Ma ya'aseh Adam? Imagine the Greeks, the philosophers, they thought about everything, and they came up with 12 crucial questions which they could not fathom the answer to, and they're referring now to the Jewish sages, and one of them was, Ma ya'aseh Adam? What should a person do, yid asher, to become financially wealthy? And the answer the sages gave was, Marbe, you should increase the amount of effort that you invest in business. Spend more time and effort being involved in business. Be'emuna. Emuna means awareness that God can see the transaction, is watching over my behavior. And they answered, well, many people tried putting in the extra 18 hours a day and it didn't work. And their response to that was, well, you have to pray too. This without this won't work. Prayer without action, action without prayer, is not a good combination. Ha b'leha loisagi. One without the other will not be sufficient. So again we see that effort does count and prayer does count. But what is prayer? Is it to persuade God that I want more? Or is prayer a reflection of me being aware of what my needs are? And why do I want a different house, a different home, a different car, a different salary, a different job? To feed what agenda and whose agenda? What is the purpose of me wanting more? If it is in order to live in comfort so that I can continue my emotional growth, my spiritual growth, we see the justification. But why should God answer my prayer if my essential need is really not for what I can then do for others, but how I will feel about my image, being that I'm driving that car, I'm living in that type of neighborhood, I can take these type of vacations. So in the prayer for more, I also need to identify, what is my purpose in wanting more? For whom am I serving? Is it only myself? My family? Extended family? Do I want to take care of certain people? I never forget, I was once selling my tapes after a class. A lady comes up to me and she's looking over an album and she says to me, "Where does the money go to?" I got the impression from the tonality and the facial expression that, you know, if it doesn't go to charity, it's not really a noble cause, it won't really count for anything. So I said to her, a line I once heard from a man at Spreeman, I said to her, "Listen, to be honest with you, it goes, all the proceeds go towards a home for unwanted children." She was impressed. And this turned her around. She started writing out this fat check. And I said, "I think I should really clarify. You see, my wife and I, we were so exasperated, we threw the kids out on the street and no one wanted them. And so I'm running a house for unwanted children." The question is, when we're asking for money, and we're asking for a raise in salary, God, please put it in the mind of my boss that when I ask him, he'll see reason. When we're praying, I also need to know what it's for. Because when I have an intent to do more for not just myself, family and others, what is God going to say? I want to sign that check. I'll test him. We'll add a few dollars or maybe a zero or two and see what happens. Does it really go towards what he said he's praying for? Or does it end up a challenge of arrogance, selfishness and greed, and that when the money arrives, finds it not so easy to knock off 10% to charity and to take care of that sister or brother that is less fortunate, or the parent who could really do with more attention or more home help? Deuteronomy 8 verses 2 to 19 tell us that wealth is a test of character. And God says there, "Why do I give you all your needs? To test you with wealth. Will you be humble and grateful, or greedy, arrogant, and then forget me?" That is the test of wealth. And many claim that the test of wealth is much harder than poverty. Because if a person has $100,000, that's 100,000 reasons to be grateful. If a person has $1,000,000, he has a million reasons to be grateful. A far greater responsibility to be happy, for now he has 100,000 or 1,000,000 reasons to be happy. And if with that I'm ungrateful, or I'm not fully appreciative, I have, in a sense, not yet passed the test of wealth, because I'm not wealthy. If this is not doing it for me, if I'm unhappy and I'm paying my bills, something's wrong. I'm not fully appreciating the fact that I have been granted the ability to be outside of unemployment, to be the envy of many thousands, if not hundreds, if not millions of others who would gladly switch places with the career I have. And so for my ingratitude, I'm the loser. And so wealth is a test of gratitude and humility. It's a test of greed and arrogance. Who is the cause of this wealth? Is it my financial acumen? Is it my ability to analyze the investment and come up with the correct formula? It's my credentials. I went to Harvard, I went to Yale. That's why I have gained what I have today. Or is it not true that you ask a businessman that invested 80% of his efforts on a particular project only to find that the breakthrough came from left field, a totally different place? And that's where the profits really came, and that venture didn't work out altogether. How many times in many types of businesses one client looks really promising and someone who we don't seem to take very seriously ends up being a major source of income? And so who really is in charge? Is it really our business acumen? Is it really our credentials? The opportunities that come into our lives are all tests to notice, is God in my life? Is he not in my life? It's not so much how much I have, it's what I respond to what I have. Gratitude, humility, greed, arrogance. The first question we are asked on the divine interview, says the Talmud in Shavas, page 31, Nasata v'natata be'imuna. Did a person do business with awareness that God was watching over the transaction? The honesty and the integrity that comes with that mindset, that is a test, and it's not easy. The purpose of going to work, the purpose of earning, the purpose of spending, investing, is one long continual test of conducting oneself with honesty and integrity. If I just fiddle a little bit with my taxes, it will make it easier on God not having to give me all the money I need. I'll be able to save it. But God has unlimited imagination that if I keep my word and do what I'm supposed to do, I will never lose out. Even though it may appear very tempting, because the client would never know, the boss might never notice, the co-workers wouldn't say a word. And the answer is, whatever test we find ourselves in, it's only another exercise in getting a gold medal in the Olympics of righteous conduct. That's the only purpose that money truthfully serves. What did King Solomon, one of the wealthiest men ever and the wisest of all, what did he declare in Proverbs chapter 2? Im tichapsena, if you search for it, kekeseth, just like you search for silver. Ukatmeinim, and like you search for hidden treasures, you search for this item, az, then, tavin yiras Hashem, you will understand what it means to be in awe of God's presence. He's telling us a very interesting metaphor. He doesn't speak about sexual craving. He doesn't speak about food, alcohol, getting on a high. He says, if one looks carefully how one exerts oneself and employs every area of one's mind and emotion to figure out how to make another buck, how to get that deal, how to clench those terms with that client, how to get a raise with my boss, how to add value to my employment position so that I will be deserving of a higher salary. If we use that metaphor for searching to find how can we see divinity in our lives, meaning in our lives, that God sends my wife, my son, my difficult daughter, responsible for making me happy, instead of me taking responsibility to change myself in my relationship to you, even if I don't like everything about you, trying to change you will never work. Ask anyone who succeeded, it's only through manipulation and fear. It never ever worked to change another person. The only thing that does change the other person is when I change in my relationship to them, then they change because they're not dealing with the same me. So says King Solomon, look carefully at the world of finances, how people are glued to the screens of NASDAQ, how people are totally absorbed in every phone call counts, every piece of detail on the Wall Street Journal has to be scoured. And if only I would employ the same
or close to effort in the exercises of righteous conduct between a husband and a wife, finding the good in my child, loving them no matter what, being kind to myself, respectful to myself, and loving my body, taking care of my weight, exercise, health, under-eating, good bowel movement. Now I know who was here last week. Taking care of myself, taking care of those closest to me, those are the exercises of righteous conduct. How we are generous or lacking in how we give to our close family members. Says the Talmud, if your wife's wardrobe is larger than yours, you are learning how to live righteously with money. We are supposed to give more kavod, more appreciation on every level to our wives and children than we give to ourselves. Their wardrobe and clothes and food should be more expensive than ours. Should be of higher quality. You still have to turn up to work with a good suit, but your wardrobe probably will not be as large. Jeremiah 9 verse 22, so declares God, Al yithalel hacham behochmato. Wise people, don't praise yourself for your wisdom. Val yithalel agibur bigvuratai, and a powerful, physically strong person, don't praise oneself for one's strength. Someone who exercises and picks up weights like him, does laps like him, could also get the same muscles. Someone who goes to the library, studies and learns and refines their mind can also learn new skills. Al yithalel ashir b'ashirasai, and the one who's wealthy, don't pat oneself on the back for one's wealth. So, God, what can we praise ourselves for? Ki im bezeis, only in this, yishalel hamishalel, should a person give praise to himself. Haskel v'yeda oisi, the one who understands and recognizes me, the divine source of all blessing in their life. Ki ani Hashem, I am the master. Mishpat utstaka, I am the one who all along has been doing kindness, justice, charity, ba'aretz, on the earth. Ki be'ele chafatzti ne'um Hashem, it's in these that I desire and deem precious, declares God. God is saying that mishpat, acting justly, tzedakah, being charitable and generous, these are the traits of righteous conducts which God says, for this one should praise oneself. You broke your record in righteous conduct. You held in your anger. You didn't share those sharp words that often do come out. Or you did not return an insult. You decided to be extra patient with that child, with one's parent, with one's spouse. One tried to listen a little bit deeper. That's called righteous living. Ladies and gentlemen, the pursuit of wealth is not about money. And the pursuit of wealth is not even about what money will bring us. The pursuit of wealth is not even those items that money will make us feel happy and fulfilled with. The pursuit of wealth is all one big training in becoming righteous. Money is there for me to notice and say, thank you. You helped me get that deal. Thank you for my employment. It's not perfect. There are many things I don't like about my boss. But God, thank you for the paycheck. When we are grateful and we put money aside for charity, it demonstrates trust. That I trust you, God, that even if I don't use all of it for me and I give some away, that is a very loud message, a demonstration that I trust you already are taking care of all my needs. I have everything, and that's why I'm willing to afford to give something away. money, wealth, is a pretext for happiness. No joking. And that is why our sages actually make them synonymous. Eizehu Ashir, who is the wealthy person, Hasameach, the one that is happy, Bechelkai, he enjoys his portion. We're going to talk about that in much greater detail next week. Wealth is a decision. It's an attitude, it's a choice to enjoy what's already wealthy in my life, and that begins with my life, health, the people that are in my life, the possessions I own. These are all plus, these are all bonus. But wealth already began when we were born. The moment we were born, we already broke all odds of being alive. There was once a story told, and if it's a story that didn't happen, it's still a true story. And many stories are that way. Of a farmer, an American farmer, devastated, finds one day that in the middle of one of his fields is a gooey black liquid, only to discover that there's an oil well. And the newspapers reported he became a multi-millionaire overnight. The question I want to pose, is this an accurate statement? Was he not already a multi-millionaire, but didn't know it? Is it possible that there's an oil well between our ears, our minds, our thoughts, our attitudes, our memories, our ability to appreciate, our capacity to be patient, our capacity to be loving, appreciative, grateful, sensitive, respectful, loyal, trustworthy? These are the real assets of a person. These are our true assets. Who we are inside of us is already our wealth. What we do and what comes into our life, what we drive and what we eat, what we can afford to put into our bodies, and the home we can afford to live in, and the location we can afford to live in, that's all bonus. The question we have to ask ourselves is, what is our bottom line definition of wealth, and how do our children get that communicated very clearly, so that when they are raised in our home, they see what counts? Money or learning? Money or spending time in communal prayer? Money or going to a class? Not that they have to be one against the other, but where a child sees that every moment dad is on the phone with another negotiation, a partner here, an investment there, a correspondence over here, a traveling visit on a business deal over there, and sees that mommy is busy shopping and shopping and shopping. The message is very clear. What counts in life is getting ahead financially, materially. I'm already, by who I am and how I'm behaving, very clearly demonstrating my values to my children. In the book, The Millionaire Next Door, a fascinating research over a 20-year period of multi-millionaires. Two doctors interviewed extensively. I have their names somewhere. And when it came to interviewing millionaires who were worth over $10 million, they had prepared in a very fancy hotel several different caviars and a vast array of expensive vintage wines and other delicacies, and how shocked they were that one after another of these multimillionaires walking in is wearing a non-matching suit, clothes which are somewhat worn, has drawn up to the hotel in a car that doesn't befit their financial status, and when offered a vintage wine, declines, and when asked why, says, "I either drink beer that's free or Beerweiser. I'm not into all these unnecessary luxuries. And this was a consistent theme they found. Besides the prudence and the frugal lifestyle, we're not talking about being miserly, we're talking about living within one's means and investing the difference so that one can afford almost anything. Deuteronomy 6, verse 6, we say it every day, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your me'odecha. Me'odecha is translated, all your talents. A second translation is me'odecha, all your possessions. Me'odecha also means all your money. Kol mamoncha. How do we serve God with all our money? The answer is, when you fill your gas tank on your way to a Torah class, you're serving God with your money. When you pay a bill on time, you're serving God with your money because you're being integral. When you pay the worker, as soon as the job is done well, you are being integral, you're serving God with your money. When you teach your children financial responsibility and you give them a balance sheet and you give them a weekly allowance, and you train them to give 10% to charity, to keep perhaps 15% as cash and the rest put away as savings or even investment at a young age, we're training our children in discipline. We are educating them, and that is serving God. When we buy our spouse a gift after a row, we're serving God by appeasing our spouse. When we give our gifts to our spouse for no reason, just out of love, we are fulfilling the command to love our fellow as ourselves. There are many manifestations of serving God with our money, with our talents, with our possessions. Deuteronomy 26:11 says, "V'samachta b'chol hatayv." You shall be happy with all the good, asher natan Hashem Elokecha, which God has gifted you. Natan translates as give, but it's the lashon of matana, which means everything we have is a gift. We are commanded to enjoy it all. It's a choice. And when we do, what a lesson for our children. Dad comes home and has been laid off work, and he still goes to his class. He still opens up and learns. He still spends some time with his kid. And when the kid overhears that today his dad lost his job and doesn't understand, why isn't dad devastated? And dad says, well, why should I be devastated? Well, dad, you're out of work. But son, I mean, let's go through my financial statement. Let's look at my assets. My health, my marriage, my kids, my relationship in the family. Well, where does that rate? And when we go through everything, my happiness and my family, my health, where does finances rate? I have a little bit of money in the bank. We still own our home. I have to look for a new job. But is this a reason for depression? Devastation? God will pull through. I'm not going to sit and wait. I'm going to work hard at finding a new job. What lesson does our child get when mom is diagnosed, God forbid, with a terminal disease and carries on smiling? But mom, why are you still smiling? Why are you asking the question? Why shouldn't I be smiling? But mom, everyone knows. I don't understand you. God has given me 56 years of health and happiness. And I'm not ready to go, and I haven't gone yet. I'm enjoying everything I've had till now, and I'm going to continue till my time is up. I've been granted beautiful children like you. Why would I be unhappy? What lesson is that for our children? Wealth is a choice of what we define it to be, bottom line, and everything else that comes on top of that is all plus, all bonus. But again, it's a training in attitude. I was once in a yellow cab in Manhattan, and I saw the name of the cab driver look Jewish, so I struck up conversation, and it turns out the man was 40 years on the cabs. So I said, boy, you have staying power. And I asked him, you know, what kept him going for 40 years? Does he enjoy his work? He said, I love it. I said, what do you love so much about it? He said, you know what I really love about my work? That every day I have breakfast in the morning, and I come home and there's supper on the table. And I didn't get what he meant, so I asked him further. True story. He said, I was in Auschwitz. And I'm so grateful that I have a job. I'm just so grateful that I earn money enough to put food on the table. As far as he was concerned, he was wealthy. I have friends in Monsey, happiest people in the world. A simple teacher, lives in a simple home. And what's the source of their happiness? 12 years married, childless, and God granted them 3 children. They're grown up children now, their eldest about 15, 16 years old. The happiest people in the world. They waited 12 years and they enjoy their kids, even when the kids are difficult. That's a test of appreciation, gratitude. If someone lives on less and loves life, someone lives on less and loves his wife, lives on less and loves his children, and they all love him back, is he wealthy or is he lacking? Because if he had a few extra bucks, they could really fix up the house to be a little bit more clean and cheerful and take a vacation, which they haven't had for several years. But what is true wealth? The two don't have to be in contrast, but we know what really counts. I'm going to suggest the following. The Talmud tells us that we should divide our assets into 3 parts. 1/3 in real estate, 1/3 in possessions, and 1/3 in cash. My Rebbe shared with me the following analogy as the parallel for a present day application. And if there's nothing else you get today than what you're about to see, I can almost guarantee you that the clarity that comes from the following picture will be well worth the evening. Some of you may be familiar, in one form or another, of the following. It's called the 3 bucket analogy. Allow me to introduce you to 3 buckets. What does that mean? You have a bucket over here, tilted. It's called the security bucket. What is called security? Paying rent, paying a mortgage, utilities, having enough money from income to cover taxes, insurance, life insurance, medical insurance, house insurance, car insurance, transportation, parking, tolls, tuition, clothing, miscellaneous, watch out for that one. All these are part of the security bucket. If what we earn, whether it's earned income or unearned income, is enough to cover all this, then the money that spills out, the money that we're earning, which is beyond our expenses, those drips of beautiful dollars fall into the second bucket, called the growth bucket. The growth bucket means that here I can put money aside for things which are beyond my daily expenses. For example, and many may argue this, but consider the importance for those who know what it means to be laid off. 2 months' wages in the growth bucket. How much money does it cost for me to live for 2 months? And find a way to gradually put that amount aside into the growth bucket. Why? Because if, God forbid, one has 1 salary and is laid off, it may take me a number of weeks till I get re-employed. What am I supposed to do in the interim? The bills continue and they're very real. An IRA to open up a pension plan or an individual retirement account. How many of us would not think twice about spending approximately $6 a day on, I don't know, a magazine, a little bit of entertainment here, a Coke and some junk food? Okay, after last week's class, maybe not the junk food. How many of us would not miss $6 a day? I think many of us would not miss $6 a day. $6 a day translates as $2,000 a year. That's an IRA account for you. accumulated over time, depending of course when you start your individual retirement account, in mutual funds can easily become $1 million retirement. A pension plan. Have money come directly out of your bank account into a pension plan. So I'm not depending on the social security checks, which will probably not support my lifestyle at that point in my life. Extra money, mutual funds is a good place, is a basically very secure place to put them. Basically, instead of putting them in stocks, which have risks of sorts, and I'm not here to teach you finances, I'm not a financial advisor. But essentially, the definition of mutual funds is you can have as many as hundreds of different companies working together, and your money is accumulated in a fund that represents all those. So if one or two go bankrupt, you still have many that are still afloat. Savings for emergencies, saving that you want to put aside to marry your children off, all that would go in the growth bucket. What would happen if I buy an item which is not on my security bucket, which I can't really afford, and it's beyond my means, and I do it with a credit card? What is the obvious downside? And what happened in this country with the fantastic invention of credit, which we all know is really a cover-up for debt? Now, some of you are familiar with receiving in the mail $25,000 pre-approved. Just sign here before June the 30th, and you will get in the mail, approved within 30 minutes, $25,000. Is that somewhat appealing to those of us who have $15,000 debt? And $25,000 would cover the debt, and then I have an extra $10,000, I could really dump the lease car that I have now and get the latest model, take the vacation and that cruise that I promised myself. Hey, there's quite a few things I could do with $25,000. But we know that it's not credit, it's debt. Now how about calling it what it really is? And you get in the mail, lady, madam, you have been pre-approved for $25,000 additional debt over and above all other debts you presently have. And if you sign here before June 3rd, you'll get a special rate of 5.9% above prime rate. Are you going to sign the application form? Why not? Because it's been called what it really is. More debt? More stress? Buying or paying for items on credit cards without the cash flow to pay off the monthly statements in full, so that I don't get myself into paying heavy interest. Because what is statistically the amount of money the average American has paid for an item bought on a credit card where they don't pay off the monthly statement in full? What is the average amount that a person is actually paying for an item after they've paid off? So the average amount of Americans paying off a credit card, by the time they paid off, how many times have they paid for that item? 300%. 300%. Understand, that's how they're making their money. So what pours out over here can go into the second bucket, the growth bucket, and money in here is working for you. And money that comes out of here can go into a third bucket, call it your future bucket or your dream bucket. In here, you want to take that cruise around the world, you want a second home, put money aside for it. But if I take money out of here for a second home, or if I take money out of here for a vacation which I can't really afford, I could take a day off or two, but a cruise around the world, that's a few thousand dollars. If I take it out of my security bucket and pay it with a loan, what am I doing? I'm living beyond my means. And that equals debt, stress, pain. If I want an early retirement, let the money that's working for me in the growth bucket go into my early retirement. Or if I want to finance a favorite charity, or if I want to make a special contribution of time or energy, money that's growing in my growth bucket can spill over to a point where it's equal to the amount of money I need on a monthly basis. And if that's the amount of money that's working for me of unearned income, hey, I can retire early and do things that I really want to do. But it starts with planning. It starts with knowing how much am I earning and what are my expenses. I'm not here to teach budgeting. We all know the basics of it. But that is the essence of Torah budgeting. Budget so I can save and invest. The purpose of budgeting is so that I know where my money's going. Don't just buy your spouse off by a check. Here, this is for the next 2 weeks and not know where it's going. Work together, decide together what's the lifestyle we really want to be able to afford and really afford, and not just on loans and gifts and depending on other people to help us out in the family. Eliminate irresponsible use of credit cards. Irresponsible use of credit cards means I'm buying items which I don't have the cash flow, I don't have the income to pay for after my security bucket has been taken care of. Which means I'm automatically getting into debt. I'm automatically going to be tempted to pay the minimum at the end of the month. And unless I'm very disciplined in how I use credit cards, never even own one except for emergencies. 3, accelerate the principal payments on a mortgage, because how do mortgages actually work? Well, what's the average interest rate that I pay on a mortgage? Fixed or adjustable? What's the approximate swing, the scale?
7.5.
Yeah, 7.5, somewhere between 6 and 9%, correct? Isn't that true? Well, not quite. Because when you start paying for the next 30 years, your first installment on your mortgage, how much of it is principal and how much of it is interest?
Zero.
Zero principal on my first payment. Well, there's actually going to be a few cents there. But it's approximately 99.9% interest. So what do you mean 6 to 9% interest? 99% interest, is it? Oh, yeah, it's 6 to 9% interest over the term of the loan. Meaning that over a period of 30 years, you will have paid out 6 to 9% interest. But guess what? Your first payment is 99% interest. Second payment, 98.9%. Third payment, 98.6%. The amount of principal you're paying off is very small at the beginning. And of course, after 10 to 15 years, that's when it swings more in your favor. And the vast majority of the money you're paying down on your monthly mortgage is principal and very little interest. Isn't all that fair, isn't it? They're giving you a lot of money up front. Where do they make their millions and billions? And the answer is, how frequently does the average American refinance in this country? Every 6 years. In 6 years of paying down a mortgage, a home equity loan, I will have paid from 99.9% interest down to 94% interest over a period of 6 years. I'm not borrowing money from the bank on a rate of 6 to 9%. It's more like 96%. If I'm amongst those who refinance within every 6 years, which is the average statistic of the average American in this country. So accelerating principal payments on mortgages means that you can, in addition to the regular mortgage payment, add another check, it doesn't have to be for the same amount, which is principal only. And by bringing your principal down faster, the amount of interest on the remaining balance is less. And that way, one can accelerate the payments to as much as 50%, meaning to say that a 30-year loan, would be reduced to 15 years of actual payments. And I will end off on the following 6 Torah strategies for wealth. Number 1, call 1-800-ALMIGHTY. This is the Gemara Nidah, page 78. God, help me pay my debts. Help me to get out of this rut. Help me to take control of my finances. Help me to become aware of how much I really earn, what's dependable income and what's fluctuating income. And let me see what my expenses are, which ones are real, the rent, the mortgage, utilities. There's an average we can figure out. They're basically fixed. You can figure it out. The tuition, insurance, Maybe with a little bit more shopping around, I can get a better rate, a better premium for my medical or my house insurance, etc. But essentially, we can figure out what our real expenses are. Watch out for the miscellaneous category, though. And within that, live to afford my real lifestyle. And we're not talking about saying no to pleasures today. We're saying yes to items of greater value tomorrow. Financial freedom, financial responsibility, just changing oneself and saying, I commit to taking control of my finances as of today, is in of itself freeing. It's therapeutic. If I'm going to follow through, and I might fall a few times here and there, but I'm going to keep and do my best to maintain consistency in the spending less than I earn and investing the difference. I have decided today to be healthier tomorrow. I've decided today to have an easier frame of mind tomorrow, less stress, happier attitude. Number two, pray before you eat. This is actually from the Zohar in Exodus, page 62a, for those who like esoteric sources. Pray before you eat. The Sephardim, we say, Poteach et yadecha u'masbia l'chol chai ratzon. That's based on this Zohar. We say before we break bread, we say, open up your hands. God provides for everyone's needs. Number three, and this is mentioned in the Sefer Chinuch, the Book of Education. Very powerful statement. He says, Baduk u'menusa. This is tried and tested, that when a person recites grace after meals with devotion, with understanding the words, and with joy, guaranteed, God will come through and pay our way. Number four, and this is the only place we're allowed to test God. Put aside 10% to charity, and we're told a veritable charity, best to Torah study. Put 10% of your profits to charity, guaranteed, you will see the return. You will see, you will never lose for putting aside 10%. Aser, put aside 10, kadesh tit aser, so that you will become wealthy. Number five, the Gemara in Shabbos, page 32b, says, taking challah from the dough is a way of becoming wealthy. You see, there's a demonstration. When we give something away, we're saying to God, you've given me all my needs, let me take care of someone else. And number six, and this is from Rabbi Victor Miller. The greatest opportunity to appreciate our livelihood is when you're writing out your bills. And you write in the memo, Toda Lashem, thank you God, I've got enough money to pay the bills. It's a reason to be grateful. It's a reason to be happy. Thank you Hashem, and thank you for your patience.